born prematurely, and I mean before they complete their pregnancy, just less than 8 months. And one of them born with cleft lip and palate.
These babies will have surgery, right?
Of course, if he survives. If he survives, yes. Since 2006, we start to notice that there is an abnormal increase in the incidence of congenital anomalies among the birth in our hospital. According to the cases we have, we register, the incidence about 14.7 per thousand live birth.
What would be a normal rate of deficiency?
It should not exceed 1 or 2 per thousand. We examined 25 families from Fallujah. Those families have babies born with birth defects. We took hair sample from the kids and from their parents, and we sent these samples to an independent lab in Germany, and we found high concentration of uranium, mercury, bismuth, and other trace elements that is not usually used by human being and not naturally present in the soil or in the plants.
In Baghdad, the authorities have to take their religious leaders' opinions into account. Their voices carry weight, and their criticism is widely heard. Jawad al-Halisi is the heir to a very influential dynasty, and he protests strongly against what he sees as an attack on his people's genetic integrity.
These deformed children are the result of the use of depleted uranium. They're deformed fetuses. An international effort is required to clean up. In the same way, they brought together 30 countries and their armies under the pretext of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. They should work together on a cleansing project, like with the Marshall Plan in Germany, because the sanitary situation in Iraq is catastrophic.
Unlike after the Gulf War of 1991, the U.S. Defense Department has never published figures concerning the use of depleted uranium during the war in Iraq in 2003. Unofficial estimates speak of over 2,000 tons. Since the beginning of my investigation, I've been trying to obtain a reaction from the Pentagon. After weeks of exchanging emails, a spokesman finally responds. Dear sir, we won't be able to accommodate your on-camera interview request. The scientific community have investigated the radiological safety and environmental impacts of depleted uranium for several decades. The Agency for Disease Control and Prevention has stated that it is aware of no cancers or cases of leukemia among workers or other populations that can be attributed to exposure to natural or depleted uranium. In Washington, Time magazine called Thomas Pickering the five-star general of the diplomatic corps. He was actively involved in the international mobilization against Saddam Hussein in 2001, but he openly opposed the war in 2003.
Iraqis who say, look, we came in and created a mess and we didn't resolve it all, in my view, have some justification for their position. I leave it to wise men, lawyers, and judges to tell you whether the answer to the Iraqi is we still owe them more. But if I were an Iraqi, I suppose they would say, yeah, you've got to create a perfect paradise here.
I can understand from an armament standpoint and from strategic planning standpoint why you'd want to have the hardest and the best weapons that could just demolish anything. They're unwilling to look at the aftermath of it and what the Geneva Convention and other things say about, you know, what you leave on the ground afterward. The military is not very well known for its ability to clean up after itself.
The official reluctance to consider the sanitary and environmental impact of depleted uranium can also be explained by economic reasons.
Obviously, from the Army's point of view, and technically, if I have to make a hole in a tank, depleted uranium is great, because it's really effective, and it's recyclable, too. I think in that situation, there's little to be said.
It's a win-win situation.
Yes, but just one detail. In Serbia, they saw that to clean one 30-millimeter head from shells that were fired, just to clean where they landed, they spent $300,000, more or less. It might be a win-win situation, but if I have to clean up afterwards...
It's a very expensive win-win situation.
Exactly, for the authorities. And those are figures that have been acknowledged and quoted.
The cost of cleaning up a zone contaminated by depleted uranium dust makes it hard to envisage that the battlefields will one day be rehabilitated. And there's worse. The depleted uranium producing countries like the US and France have to deal with the accumulation of increasingly vast stocks. More than 700,000 tons in the US, almost 200,000 tons in France. Robert Alvarez, a former advisor to the U.S. Energy Department, has been sounding the alarm bells for a number of years.
What we are dealing with, in a certain respect, is what I call national sacrifice zones, that we, in order to amass nuclear weapons in this country, we created very large, profound areas of contamination where we simply lack the capability and the technology to restore them to their original conditions, much less to conditions that would allow even limited uses. So these are areas that we more or less have to sacrifice in the name of nuclear deterrence.
It is by chance that I make an astonishing discovery in Iraq, which confirms Robert Alvarez's alarmist predictions. Close to Basra Airport, the broken shells of tanks destroyed in 2003 are lined up along the road. Soldiers tell me of incidents previously kept secret.
The tanks were contaminated by uranium. A team from the Environment Ministry examined them, and they confirmed the contamination. From time to time, the Americans and the British come here, and they take tanks away somewhere, transporting them further away from the airport. But we don't know what becomes of them.
But I want to know. For the contaminated scrap metal, this mysterious destination is the end of the road, and finding it would mean the end of my investigation. I decide to speak to General Jabbar, who commands the border police in the Basra region.
Some of the scrap was moved to this desert place. How do you call it?
It's called Afr el Batin.
When was it moved there?
The program was set up in 2008. To this provisional site, they've transported 150 tons of scrap metal.
What happened to the scrap when it gets there? When they bring it there, then they put it in the ground. What do they do with the scrap?
They dig and they put it in holes in the ground. They simply take it from one place to another. Obviously, it's in the desert. But according to our information, there are water tables below. Scientific reports say it's potentially dangerous for the water.
I do my utmost to get to Afr el Batin. I need an authorization and an escort. General Jabbar promises to help. But then a counter order arrives from Baghdad. The affair is beyond his authority, and only a minister can give me the required permission. I know Iraq too well. It will never happen.
One of the things you learn as a child is clean up your own mess. Don't expect somebody else to come in here and pick up your crayons and your toys. So we did this war of choice, and my view is that we have a responsibility for the mess we leave. We can't walk away and just say, well, we don't care.
The depleted uranium question, like any question involving armies, weapons and wars, suffers from a lack of transparency, from a lack of precise democratic control on both national and European levels. I think the priority is to continue the fight on the UN level, which is very useful, and also within the European Union, so that we can obtain a moratorium on depleted uranium munitions.
Countries that have used depleted uranium weapons, quite obviously, are not interested in being raked over the coals for a weapon system they feel they have a right to use and which they feel is not dangerous. But we will see. The international community doesn't stand still on these kinds of things. And I think that if there's an increasing effort to say, look, here are the damages, and you have to have something concrete, and you have to say that this is more than a supposition, and that we have done some research, and unfortunately, you have to bring examples of where beyond the pure use of depleted uranium as a tank buster, you have created a special kind of damage to the individuals beyond what normally conventional weapons create. Then I think you have a basis for moving ahead.
Depleted uranium munitions were invented in the 1970s to combat Moscow's armored divisions. The Soviet enemy has disappeared, but this all-powerful arsenal has remained. Those responsible for authorizing its use will one day have to be accountable to the victims and explain why they turned a deaf ear to every appeal for caution.
The most brave people are the people who've never been to war. The ones who think war is such a great deal and want to go to the parades and stand there and see the flags go by and hear the bands. They haven't been anywhere near what it's like when they come.
And that's it for this week's episode. And don't forget to share your thoughts and comments with us. Until next week and another Aperture. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Indeed, the combination of low winter rainfall, fewer new shrubs and plant growth this spring, and a predicted dry summer are of great concern to climatologists and wildfire researchers. The upcoming wildfire season in the U.S. could top even 2020, which for the state of California was its most severe in modern history, says Nicole Carlis, writer, in an article titled "Wildfire Researchers Forecast 2021 Fire Season in the U.S. That May Be More Severe Than 2020. Stay tuned for the details, please. Earlier this April, the researchers at San Jose State University's Wildfire Interdisciplinary Research Center in Northern California were gathering camis at Blackberry Hill, a site in nearby Santa Cruz Mountains. In the past few years, it was a site that they had revisited to gather samples of native shrub. While surveying the land at the site, the researchers made a disconcerting discovery. New green growth was nowhere to be found. Wow, never seen April fields look so dry, the research center tweeted. In a separate tweet, the researchers stated that fire season in 2021 was looking grim. The reason? This year's live fuel moisture content, that is FMC, a metric which measures the ratio of moisture to natural combustible material, is historically low. Average fuel moisture content in the wild is 137%. Low is usually considered to be 115%. Right now, in 2021, the Northern California region is at 97%. Lower fuel moisture content means higher flammability and therefore higher chances of wildfires. Fire danger is a function of not only the weather, but the condition of the fuels. And the most important thing about the fuels is their moisture content, said Craig Clements, a professor and director of the Wildfire Interdisciplinary Research Center at San Jose State University. Clements said he was shocked that they didn't see new growth. Every year for 2 weeks during the spring, Clements and his colleagues go to the same three sites near the Santa Cruz Mountains to take samples of scrub clippings to measure the FMC. Usually April is a good month for new growth and moisture. It's when Clements and other researchers expect to measure their highest FMC ratios. Hence why the low ratio and lack of new growth was so shocking. Clements checked in with other researchers who sampled various sites around the state of California and found that an astonishing number of sites are reportedly drier than normal. Some sites have new growth, but it's still not what we expect in a normal year, and this is directly related to drought, Clement said. No rain or low precipitation equals drier than average fuel moistures. Indeed, the state of California has found itself in yet another drought this year, meaning the likelihood of another severe wildfire season following a catastrophic 2020 wildfire season is high. But it's not just California. It's the entire West Coast that is poised to have a wildfire season more catastrophic than the last. Indeed, the combination of low winter rainfall, fewer new shrubs and plant growth this spring, and a predicted dry summer are of great concern to climatologists and wildfire researchers. The upcoming wildfire season could top even 2020, which for the state of California was its most severe in modern history. Over 10,000 wildfires tore through the state, nearly 4.2 million acres burned. Its northern neighbor, Oregon, also experienced one of its most destructive wildfire seasons in modern history, as did the state of Washington. In total, wildfires burned 10.2 million acres on the West Coast, killing at least 37 people and causing over $19.8 billion in damages. The long-term fire weather forecast doesn't look good, said Susan Pricard, a fire ecologist at the University of Washington. Pricard agreed that one of the main reasons was that in parts of all of California and a lot of the Southwest, fuels are very dry. Nicholas Bond, a climatologist for the state of Washington and principal research scientist at the University of Washington, said that the state of Washington had a higher than normal snowpack this winter, which was quite wet. That might seem like good news, yet historically there is a trend over the past decade of increasingly destructive wildfires each year. That trend is staring us in the face, Bond said. He noted that an anticipated hot, dry summer will cause the snowpack to melt. Even though we have right now an abundant snowpack right now, that's not going to last forever, he added. As the snow melts in the later part of the summer, the landscape dries out and becomes prime fuel for wildfires, with the exception of the highest elevations in the mountains. It helps to have those great snowpacks for various reasons. For forest health, it's a good thing, Bond said. But even if you have a good snow year, like we have right now, you can't have a bad fire season. In spring 2020, wildfire researchers began expressing their concern about a severe wildfire season. But strange weather events like lightning storms in California made matters worse. Bond said weather forecasters predict a hot and dry summer across the West Coast, but it can't be predicted now if there will be strong winds or similar storms. We can't anticipate whether we're going to have one of those weather events or not. Chances are there won't be anything of that severity this year. But that's kind of a wild card, Bond said. Climate change is a real thing, and this is one of the manifestations that we are having in the West. As Pricard explained, the fire season is not entirely in the hands of Mother Nature. There is a human factor too. The dice are loaded, but we still get to roll the dice, she said. Paraphrasing a colleague, I thought that was a perfect way to describe the upcoming fire season, because with these dry fuels and these longer, hotter, often windier summers that we are getting, but the variable that we don't know about is lightning and human fire starts. And that last possibility, of course, is preventable.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on the blessed month of Ramadan.
Some of the characteristics of the month of Ramadan. Certain characteristics of the month of Ramadan have been mentioned in the du'as recorded in Sahih al-Sajjadiyah or other books. The month of Ramadan has been referred to as the month of penitence and the month of surrender, which is in Sahih al-Sajjadiyah. The meaning of surrender is identical to that of the word submit in the ayah. And whoever submits himself wholly to Allah, and he is the doer of good to others, he indeed has taken hold of the firmest thing upon which one can lay hold. The Holy Quran, chapter 31, verse 22. Whoever submits himself wholly to Allah means surrendering one's heart and soul and making them submissive to divine will, divine orders, and sharia. Ramadan has also been referred to as the month of purification, which means that Ramadan contains a quality that purifies people from impurities. When an impure precious metal like gold is placed inside a furnace, it is purified. Purification means purifying human soul of impurities.
رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 يا حبيب رمضان ليتك دوما قريب
People benefit from speaking to Allah the Exalted during Ramadan. People benefit from speaking to Allah the Exalted, being addressed by Him, praying to Him and opening up their hearts to Him. They do these by reading the prayers of the month of Ramadan, reading the Abu Hamza al-Thumali dua, and the du'as that one reads during the days, nights, and early mornings of Ramadan are actually a kind of speaking to God, making requests from God, and getting close to God. These people benefit from these things too. Therefore, they benefit from all the blessings of the celebration. Avoiding sins is of higher priority, and perhaps it is more important than these du'as in some ways. These people do not commit sin in this month either. In the same sermon, which was delivered by the Holy Prophet ﷺ and the Commander of Faithful ﷺ, asked the Holy Prophet, which act is the most blessed act? The Holy Prophet ﷺ answers, avoiding sins. Avoiding sins is of higher priority than Islamic obligations. It prevents one heart and soul from corruption.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the motto of France is freedom, liberty, and fraternity. Many French would say that there is a major gap in the slogan of the country and reality on the ground for its people. This as the French National Assembly has passed a new security law giving police even more power. One of the most controversial parts of the law prohibits the sharing of images of police with malicious intent. Now, critics say it is vague and can be used to stifle freedom and initiate a more severe crackdown. We're going to start off this discussion crossing over to Paris, joined by correspondent there, Chris DeHaan. Chris, well, fill us in on what this law could mean.
Well, concretely, this law means certainly a limitation of individual and public liberties. So the police impunity will increase, that's for sure. Police powers are increasing, that's for sure. Now it will be interesting to investigate the exact degree of the limitation of these freedoms, because France is still not a police state. There are still democratic institutions functioning, political parties, associations, trade unions are working, but it's not sure in what kind of degree, demonstrations, for instance, will be allowed in the near future. So it's certainly a limitation of public liberties, but we are not yet in a dictatorship.
And let me get our next guest in, too, on this independent journalist, if I have him out of Marseille, Sylvain Marcadia. Your take on this. In your opinion, why has the Macron government pushed for this? They were very aggressive in wanting to make sure this legislation get passed.
Yes, it's a good question. Like, I really believe that the party in power, Macron's party, La République En Marche, is trying to attract voters who would vote for the far-right party, Rassemblement National, headed by Marine Le Pen. So this move that is basically supporting the actions of the police, supporting the impunity of the police, is a move to attract these conservative votes in favor of Macron for the coming elections next year. So I do believe that this is one of the objectives. The other is also to reassure the police in a moment where it is becoming like a key element of the French institutions. Like the public opinion is more and more engaged against the government. We've seen the Yellow Vest movement erupting a few years ago, a few months after Macron was elected and after his first policies. And this is a way to support, reassure the police in their actions against these movements that are opposing the power, the party in power, I believe.
Okay, let me welcome my next guest out of Paris, journalist and geopolitical analyst Gerard Coleman. Gerard, good to have you with us. Your take on exactly what this means now. I mean, has France transitioned? Is it leaning more and more to the right? And
just continually trying to limit individual freedom, because we see this particular law, the security law. We also have seen the separation law. Your assessment of what is going on in general in the country?
Well, it's been leading to financial rights since the 1960s, really when the Rothschild Bank took over, particularly in the 1970s. So the trajectory of French politics from the late 60s to now has been towards the extreme financial right. Socially, in terms of social mores, the regime in place is essentially a consequence of 1968. So that's what goes for the left today. I don't really know what you would call that in terms of right or left. But I think the reality is that we have a police state, and now they're giving police full powers. So we have a situation where drones, for example, can go into people's houses. Police can use drones. They did use them in the lockdown last year. They used drones in different parts of the country, but that caused controversy. I mean, it was a lot of people opposed to the idea of being followed around by drones, police drones. Now it will give police those kind of powers. We did see massive police brutality and repression during the Yellow Vest uprisings. We've seen massive police brutality right throughout the lockdown period over the last year. Just the other day in Paris, people were hunted out of parks and hunted out of the Seine area where people used to have picnics. People are not allowed to live effectively anymore in France, and that's not an exception, that's all over Europe. It is illegal to meet people, it is illegal pretty much to do anything other than go to work, wear a mask and so on and come home. So what it means is that it basically gives the police now the possibility of following you around with a drone, openly surveilling the whole population. And also, you know, private life is gone. They can legally go into your home. They have some suspicion about you. Now, suspicion about you might be that you're not wearing a mask in your home, if they make that the next law, which they could, because they're pretty much most of the time now here, when you read the newspapers, every day a new law is being passed which takes away some other fundamental human liberty. So they spend most of their time discussing what liberty they're going to take away next. And so if you were to look at Paris now, particularly since the attacks in 2015-16, the series of terrorist attacks, it's police state, there's police everywhere. And, you know, if you compare it to so-called totalitarian countries, let's say like Iran, and I've been there many times, you don't see the same police concentration in the streets. This is a police state, and people of the police, if you ask here about the mask issue, for example, wearing masks in the street in Paris, I mean, some people believe in that and they comply, but a lot of people don't like being forced to do things. And most people I've spoken to said they wear them because they fear the police. So that you have a situation where people live in fear of the police all the time. Generally, the population in France is really very, very sick of fines. They get fined for living here.
Okay.
Speeding fines, with the sort of Internet of Things coming in, everything is being surveilled. So, you know, you've got sensors everywhere picking everything up. Now you're going to have biometric cameras. So, you know, that means that essentially you're under surveillance all the time. And,
okay, stay with me, Gerard. Let me get Sylvain back in this discussion. Sylvain, you heard what Gerard was saying. Do you think that the majority of French people actually support these new security measures?
I don't think so, no. I really do not believe they do.
So why has the French Assembly, I mean, they're supposed to be representatives of the French people. Has happened that this legislation then has been passed?
Well, this probably has to do with like the French particularity in politics, that even though politicians get like elected and voted for, they seldomly respect their promises once they get into power. Macron was never elected to vote these laws. Actually, there are many parts of his program that he never applied or delayed, and he has used the COVID-19 crisis very conveniently for this. And no, this is basically, yes, like the reason why the assembly managed to vote this law. And I generally also believe that the establishment, the political establishment that voted this law is afraid, has learned the lessons from the Yellow Vest movement, feared for the stability of their well-being and everything, and they are ready to ensure that the status quo, like the Fifth Republic, as we are we call our institutions, are going to be maintained, and that actually have many issues that should be discussed in order to eventually come out of this system that is very vertical in terms of power, gives a lot of power to the president, and amongst other many other issues. But the representative system of France has issues that should be addressed instead of giving more rights to repress demonstrators and people opposing the police, which is actually a fundamental right to demonstrate. This is a right that's being denied little by little, as mentioned.
Okay, well, Gerard, where does the press fit in here? I mean, will they be able to show images from the scene of demos when police are involved, or where do you see things going from that perspective?
Well, the press is a system of state propaganda in all Western countries, and it's always been like that. So the press is the state, really. There isn't a separation. There's very little criticism allowed of state policy in the press. The press is there as a communication device of the state. So it's not going to affect the working of journalists, because they mostly publish fake news anyway. And the demonstrations that will be allowed, the demonstrations that will take place, will be demonstrations which are state-sponsored. So, for example, climate change demonstrations are given full support of the state, full support of the banks and the corporations. Gay pride is fully supported by the corporations and banks and the state. All these kinds of demonstrations will be promoted, but the real demonstrations will not be allowed, and we're going to see a criminalization of the type of Gilets Jaunes protests, the anti-mask protests, the anti-forced vaccine protests. There haven't been many in France in comparison to other countries, but this will make it more difficult for people with real issues, real life issues, to demonstrate. And the press doesn't cover those issues anyway, so they're not going to be concerned about the repression of the real dissidents in the country. We've just seen a dissident released from prison today. Hervé Vessel was put in prison because of his writings, and so now we have political prisoners in France, and we have more prison sentences, prominent dissident intellectuals, and that's the future. They're actually emptying a lot of the prisons. They're letting prisoners, actual criminals, go, and they're filling them with political dissidents. And that is the future right now.
Well, Sylvain, now officials say that the law is needed to protect law enforcement officers. Your take on that side of things, what do you think?
I'll use a quote from David Dufresne, who is a French journalist who has been writing extensively on the Yellow Vest movement and on issues of global security in France and freedom of speech, and he was calling this law Orwellian, even in its name, global security. What security are we talking about? Are we talking about the security of the citizens, or are we talking about the security and impunity of the law enforcement forces? So, obviously, there is an issue with these laws, and they are definitely not a move in favor of freedom of speech. They are actually a deterrent for independent journalists to engage in their work and to document the actions of the police. I mean, the issue here is police brutality. The issue is not security of police officers. There have been like so many cases of police violence documented by citizens in the streets, and this is what like the police and Gérard Darmanin, the Ministry of Interior, are trying to go against with this law that is basically giving this impunity and preventing citizens of doing their work, which is to report police violence and other actions during demonstrations.
Well, Gerard, we've also witnessed so many different laws. One of them is the separation law in France, where Muslims have been the target. I mean, we're just seeing more and more and more laws that seem to be weeding away the rights of the people in France. I'm just wondering about the French people in general. The French people have more of a love for independence and individual freedom. Why aren't we seeing more of a reaction? I mean, we have seen some demonstrations, but do you think that we're going to see increase outward show of being upset to this new law by the French people, or have they just learned to acquiesce and accept it?
Well, there's two points there. You mentioned the Muslims and then the, you know, the French love of liberty, and I think one on the Muslim issue, the police in France are highly integrated with the Israeli Defense Forces, Mossad, the even Israeli militia like Fatah, who are banned, are so extreme they're banned in Israel. They have links to the French police. So that would explain focus as well on Muslims, because the constant obsession about Muslims in France, the danger and so on, and then many very suspect terrorist attacks, and of course a catastrophic foreign policy. None of that is ever discussed in the debate. So that, you know, that is that explains why you have the repression of the Muslim community. But on the other issue of the general love of liberty, well, it's a farce. You know, Republican liberty has been a farce from the very start, because it's not based on any solid philosophy. It's based on a false theory of the human being, and it's based on 18th century Enlightenment ideas, which are false ideas, and we're seeing the consequence of that now. When you get that kind of republic, eventually you have to pass laws against every fundamental liberty. So it makes a farce of the whole idea of liberty in the first place. And so we're seeing the collapse, essentially, of the principles of the French Revolution, but in the context where those principles are becoming the principles of a global government system. So, you know, France is part of a much wider agenda here. Europe and the world is going through the same process. There is a specificity in France, of course, which is the French love of liberty. But the we haven't seen any manifestation of that in the last year. If you compare France, for example, to Germany, millions of people demonstrated against the lockdown in Germany. They demonstrated against the pseudoscience promoted by the media and so on and so forth. There's been very little of that in France. So I think...
Why is that the case?
One of the reasons, I would say, is that the French were simply worn out from demonstrating with the Yellow Vest. I mean, you had the Yellow Vest movement just galvanized. It just, you know, mobilized thousands of people for, 2 years? It just went on and on and on and on. It went nowhere. And in a way, I think it sort of it exhausted an awful lot of people. And then after that, with the coronavirus, they were kind of taken by surprise. But I also think it's the French are very brilliant media propagandists, and they have a much more sophisticated propaganda system than any other country I know. They are very good at preventing, preempting counter arguments and preempting counter movements. They do it better than most of the countries. In the last year, you compare the Anglophone media to the French media. French have been very good at at basically dividing and conquering the French elites, that is. And I think that's one of the reasons they basically, you have a far-right party, sort of a far-right party, which is in bed with the Zionists, has not really had, you know, made any significant opposition to the Macron regime in the last year. Could have had many opportunities to come out and be the hero of the people, open everything up and put the bad guys in jail. Marine Le Pen is completely sold out And we're seeing that with a lot of the far-right parties in Europe, so-called far-right parties, that they are basically going along with the technocratic agenda. And they're not coming out on the side of the people. So that's another reason that you have extreme manipulation on the right and on the left here. And, you know, that there is no coherent view of opposition that can unite the opposition to put an end to this. Because you have to see that a lot of these agendas are linked. You know, a police state, giving police almost absolute powers, and then a lockdown situation, a medical dictatorship, forced vaccination, et cetera, et cetera. They're all linked. They're all part of a the takeover of society by another. You know, we need to understand that that transcends class, race, and a lot of other issues that divide people. This is if what is happening is that the wealthiest people in the world have taken over the world. They've taken over pretty much every state in the world. And okay. You know, France is you know, an example of a country where they've done this to a very extreme extent, and they've managed to do it without much opposition until now. Because they have, you know, they've been studying techniques of propaganda, I think, better than any other country.
Okay. And on that note, I'd like to thank my guests for being with us.